This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Place to Be Nation, welcome back to another wonderful episode of Pop Goes the Classics. I am, of course, one of your tri-hosts. I love that we adopted that word, by the way. It's fantastic. I am one of your tri-hosts, Miranda Berthold, coming to you. If you have not heard, I am no longer in Slovakia. I am in the great country of Germany. But, of course, I am not by myself, and we make up two countries of representation here with my hosts. And, of course, we have from one side of the great country of the United States, my good friend Steve. Steve, how are you doing today?
I am doing good. It's a very interesting film we're about to talk about today. So definitely one of those you have one opinion on or the other. So looking forward to it.
That is very true. And of course, we wouldn't be able to round out this trio without our wonderful leader of the pack, Mr. Andy Atherton himself. Andy, how are you doing over there today on the other side of America?
Yes, two countries, three time zones. I am great. It's great to be back once again with you two. And it's been a little bit since you've been in the driver's seat, Miranda, on the pod here. You haven't been there since the Sword in the Stone.
I didn't realize that, which has some correlation, if you think about it, to our film that we're kind of going to discuss today.
Yeah, just a little peek. Like, we kind of go around and say, like, you know, who loves the movie more than the others, maybe, or has great memories, and that's usually who gets to sit in the driver's seat and kind of lead the conversation. So, yeah. Looking forward to hearing Miranda, how much she loves this movie, and you'll hear how much I'm hoping it's not the last episode of this podcast. and maybe the Muppet Pod could get... No, I'm kidding. No, I like I always say, and I say this when I talk about Marvel as well, like, bad Marvel movie, a bad Disney movie, or a movie that you like not as high on, it's still a good movie. You know, it's just a movie that may not appeal to you, or you may just have some issues with, but it's still a good movie most of the time.
Well, I am sure all of the good people at home are like, well, what the heck are you going to talk about then? Well, if you're following along, you already know where I'm going with this. And we're on our 25th animated feature in the Disney animated canon. And this is Disney's first PG-rated animated film. And it is based on the first of two books in Lloyd Alexander's The Chronicles of Prydain, which is a 5-volume book series, which is based on a Welsh mythology. The funny thing about this movie is that it holds an infamous spot in Disney's long history of animated films, but is nicknamed the film that almost killed Disney. And that makes me sad, because today we are talking about the 1985 Black Cauldron. That I absolutely love, if you guys could not tell. It is obviously set in the middle land of Prydain, which is in the early Middle Ages, and the film centers on an evil Horn King who hopes to secure an ancient magical object known as the Black Cauldron that will aid him in his desire to conquer the world. I thought it was going to be fantastic, and I think it is fantastic, but let's just all kind of, like, go around the table here. We all know Miranda loves it. So do you remember your first time seeing this movie, how you felt about it then, and how you feel about it now? Steve, why don't you go first? Because I know somebody else is going to rain on my parade.
So I'm being perfectly honest here. The first time I ever saw this film was in 2020 when I did it for the Wonderful Reviews of Disney. Mm-hmm. I had heard about it, obviously, and I had heard about the reputation that it had. So it was one I just always kind of, like, you know, avoided a little bit. You know, eventually, you know, it was one of those, like, at some point maybe I'll get around to watching it, but just, you know, just never kind of hit my radar. It's actually interesting because it was released on July 24th, 1985, which was a little bit a week. So it was actually the last film that was released before I was born. I was born about actually 10 days later on August 2nd. So,
oh, really?
Yes. So, you know, kind of the last film before my lifetime and essentially the first one of my lifetime. So, but yeah, it was, you know, again, like I said, I had always heard about its reputation as being one of those kind of, you know, like you said, you know, it was called the film that nearly killed Disney, which if you think about it, it's like considering the films that we've had prior and the films that we have coming, kind of a, you know, not the best title to kind of associate with it. So, but when I eventually did get around to watching it, as I said, for the reviews, I was like, you know what, I'm gonna go in as I always do with these films, with an open mind. You know, maybe it'll surprise me, maybe it won't be as bad as the reputation states. And while I can say it's, you know, it's not up there with some of the other films that I personally enjoy, have enjoyed, that we've watched to this point that are coming, you know, it was not as bad as I thought it, you know, as I think its reputation states. I think, like Andy, I think there's some things about it that that it could have been done maybe a little better. And we'll obviously get to some of my my thoughts about it as we go along. But yeah, it's definitely not as bad as I think its reputation holds.
I would say that for sure. It is not as shoddy as everyone is making it out to be. It's not. But let me now be disappointed. And let Andy have his opinion, because people are entitled to them even if they stink.
Even if they're wrong, right?
Even if they're wrong.
Now, yes. Look, I think this is very well animated movie. I think the voices are really good. There's lots of good elements here. Okay. I don't remember first time I watched this. I mean, I know I've watched it before, having to watch it before this discussion, but I couldn't tell you plot elements. Like, I just, it's one of the rare blind spots for me when it comes to Disney animation. I just did not remember anything about this movie. And, you know, I went in with an open mind. I'm like, Miranda loves this movie. I'm, you know, sure. And I'm like, I could see why you love it. And there's nothing wrong with you loving it, because it's in your wheelhouse. Fantasy.
Oh, for sure.
You know, you love Sword in the Stone, which I think is boring. But, you know, that's more your cup of tea, or your cup of telly and tea, cheap plug. I just found, as the movie goes on, I just found issues with some of the plot elements. I found some issues with some of the characters and some of the things, you know. I think the Horn King, I'll get into that a little more later, but I think probably most visually terrifying villain we've had, at least up to now. I'd have to really sit down and think, but I mean, he's scary looking just from the moment you see them. I like that it goes back into medieval times, but I think because it was targeted at a little bit older, it's a little darker, and I think people weren't looking for this kind of story at this time. I think this just wasn't what, you know, it just doesn't fit the time period. This is a movie that probably should have come out. This is probably something from, like, it would fit better in their 70s catalog, I think, but not in the middle of the 80s. So
maybe
that's
the
just 90s. Maybe the 90s, but it would have been a letdown after what happens in the beginning of the night. You know, from 1990, yeah, anything is a letdown, really. I mean, that bar goes up so friggin' high that it's so hard to be that next film. It's like, you know, what, being that act that follows that, you know, that act, you know, that great act that goes out there and kills it. But yeah, it's a really well-made movie, but it just didn't register with me that much.
Okay. It is a darker film. And I do have a question before I kind of get into the plot for those that are listening and maybe chose not to watch it or didn't care for it. This was Disney's first non-musical film. Up until now, we have had very musical, animated, catchy tunes going on in all of our feature films. So this is the first one that does not. It doesn't have in character or out of character, just soundtrack singing. Do you think for either one of you that was negative? Because for a lot of people, when they polled them on like why you didn't like it, they saw that as like negative, and they felt like music was a key component of Disney, basically Disney movies, and that that's what took them kind of not liking it. The fact that it was so dark in theme, and that there was no music. So what do you think, Andy?
I think it definitely does not feel very Disney, actually. And that could be one of the reasons, but I don't see where music would have played. I mean, maybe like dark, ominous music, kind of like similar to what we'll get like in Hunchback, I guess, of Notre Dame. But I don't really see where music could take place. There's not a really good spot for it, unless Gergi wants to sing like a silly song. I did like Gergi because he's voiced by John Byner, one of my favorite voice actors from this time period. But I could definitely see that, because it does not feel Disney-esque, really. I think it's a departure, basically, which not a lot of people like, especially when it comes to Disney. And you know, when somebody is so, you know, entrenched in a fandom, when there's a deviation, people just don't like it. They don't want this is what they know, this is what they love. We want this. Don't give us that. You know, I love butter on my toast. Cream cheese may be great, but I don't want that cream cheese. My comparisons are, I'm really going crazy with my comparisons over the last few episodes. Sorry.
Yeah. Steve, how do you think the music played a role into your influence of the movie, like your opinion of the movie? Do you think it kind of is what made it not the greatest?
I have to agree with Andy. It's definitely, this film definitely feels very un-Disney-like. I mean, we talked to comparisons to Sword in the Stone. It's like the animation style feels very much the same as that film. And it's funny. It's kind of like... call it like a cross between Lord of the Rings and The Legend of Zelda, and Disney trying to kind of combine those two elements together. And I just don't think songs would have fit anywhere. Even though you have Flam, who's the almost like a minstrel with his little harp, but something with the witches, maybe they could have done like a little sing songy thing. But other than that, it really, like, music, the score itself, I think, is really good. Like, it really fits the film well. But having songs in it just would have felt forced. Because we talk about some of these other, some of the other films we talked about, how, it feels like some of the songs they kind of felt shoehorned in to make them feel like a Disney film, because like Andy said, we've been almost kind of like trained to that point to have songs in these films, and sometimes they're warranted, sometimes they're not. And this was one of those films where I think songs just would have felt very, it would have felt forced, and it would have made it, I think, it would have hurt the film as opposed to help the film.
I could totally see that. I myself usually love the music. This time I kind of enjoyed that it didn't have it. I like the idea of, like you said, just like the score. Like we get in Lord of the Rings, where you have like this beautiful score that you could listen to in the background while reading or working, but that it's not really like, you're not going to catch yourself accidentally singing the words in a environment that you should not be kind of situation. So it's interesting that all of our changes are happening at once. Like we mentioned in the last movie, there was kind of like a title change within Disney. Obviously, we get darker. We have a higher rating than we're used to. As a matter of fact, it was almost a PG-13 rating. But I think it's important to note, when I say it was almost PG-13, is that MPAA rating system had only been introduced in 1968. And so they were still kind of like playing with it. And it did require cuts of the movie to actually be bumped down to PG and not PG-13, because apparently in test groups, children actually ran out of this movie It was deemed too disturbing, and children ran out of the movie in tears. So I could see where some people are like, this is your downfall, Disney. And maybe there's something wrong with me because I enjoyed it. As a child and still now. It is in my wheelhouse, though, as Andy said. It's based off a Welsh story. If you're not new here, you know how much I love all things British, Welsh, Irish. It speaks to me. It resonates. So this film itself starts with a voiceover explaining what the legend of the Black Cauldron is. A legend has it that the mystic land of it's pronounced different ways depending on where you're from. I'm from Southern America, so forgive me if it sounds weird. From Prydain, there was once a king so cruel and so evil that even the gods feared him. And since no prison could hold him, he was thrown alive into the crucible of molten iron. There, his demonic spirit was captured in the form of a great black cauldron. And for uncounted centuries, the black cauldron lay hidden, waiting, while an evil man searched for it, knowing that whoever possessed it would have the power to resurrect an army of deathless warriors and with them rule the world. So already kind of very Lord of the Rings-esque in children form. So on a small farm, we have Taryn, a young boy who is relegated to a life of an assistant pig keeper. And he longs for joining the war against the Horned King, and he wants to become a hero despite the insistence of Dalban and his guardian that war is not a game, and it's not. So on a very kind of, as they put it, nondescript morning, Hinwin, the pig that Taryn looks after, seems to go crazy. And Dalban explains that Hinwin is a magical pig who can create visions using water, which Taryn was previously unaware of. Using Hinwin's powers, Dalban discovers that the Horn King is actually after the Black Cauldron, which we have been told at this point, and he seeks to capture Hinwin and use her to find it. And realizing that Hinwin simply cannot fall into the hands of the Horn King, he orders Taryn to leave the farm and take Hinwin into hiding. And the scene then kind of shifts to our Horned King, which, as Andy said, is kind of scary, who plans to resurrect a number of these fallen warriors as his army of zombies known as the Cauldronborn in a plot to capture the Black Cauldron. So, guys, how did you feel about this opening? It was kind of a very, again, we're going to say this a lot in this episode, very different from what we've done before. We have a voiceover explaining what's happening and what the backstory is. And it's already very dark. We're talking about visions, magical visions, a horned king that wants to, like, rule everything, and a kid that is a pig keeper that just got thrown a lot of responsibility. So how did we feel about this, like, opening introduction to basically everything super quickly?
Hey, you go ahead first. Oh.
Yeah.
I like that aspect of it. Again, had this been, I think really, had it been released by somebody else under a different banner, I think the movie would be more well received.
Okay.
I think it's a very good opening. I tried to be open-minded, but I'm sitting there like, the pig's got psychic powers. I don't remember this part of it. basically, and then there's the pig has a pensieve from Harry Potter that it kind of kind of similar to. We're setting up the tale that we have to go on and about this deus ex machina, the Black Cauldron, which, you know, I mean, the Horn King is we get nothing. We know nothing about the Horn King, just that he's this, is he human? Is he otherworldly? I mean, that's one of the issues I have with the Horn King. I mean, he's terrifying. I think he's very matter of fact later on as he talks, and which makes him even scarier. Like, he doesn't scream and yell at times, which is kind of terrifying. It's like when your parents are calm and you're like, when are they going to lose their shit? Like, this is so, like, you're waiting for the other shoe to drop with him. I think Taryn is a fine protagonist that we're going to follow here. But I, again, it's just very dark and un-Disney-esque, but I think if it's if there's a different label on the box, I think it changes your perception of the movie. So, but I think it's good storytelling though at this point in the movie.
I definitely agree. I think just the fact that, you know, if it's a Disney film, like you said, you know, our expectations are so high going in. I think there's a lot of they try to answer, you know, kind of set the stage for you, like I said, with that opening sequence, you know, opening narration talking about, you know, this, you know, the cauldron, and it's like you're still kind of left with a bunch of, you know, kind of like questions about it. I do like the introduction of Taran. I think he's, you know, very kind of unassuming, you know, young boy who wants to, you know, has these big aspirations to be a warrior and a hero. And it's like you said, yeah, Henwen, you know, a pig that's that can see into the future. Very kind of interesting choice there. And as for the Horn King, he's definitely very I actually kind of compare him somewhat, kind of, you know, compare him like as a great, almost like a great value Chernenbog from Fantasia.
I did get a lot of Night on Bald Mountain feelings from him a little bit, I think.
Yeah, that's kind of like the same design. Like you said, yeah, visually he looks terrifying, but just like he feels so like generic villain number five. Almost it's like you don't like, he has like his only goal is like, you know, to find the cauldron and to resurrect like this like army of the dead and, you know, unleash it onto the world. But it's like it just feels so it's just so like standard for a villain. Like I actually kind of find his little henchman Creeper there to be more interesting than him.
Yeah.
So that's kind of that's what this, you know, what I think about that.
Yeah, I think Creeper is a very underrated henchman. I think good design, good character, funny, very underserved. I mean, and the fact that I don't know. Did we get there yet? Are we in the castle yet, Miranda? Or are you still getting there in your description?
So he's basically going through that now. So we can go ahead and kind of talk about that. You know, he's been daydreaming about being a warrior, and he kind of got off into his little world. So he's lost Henwen, basically. And in looking for her, of course, real quick, let's introduce Gurgi, who is a great side character that I absolutely love. Gurgi loves apples. He's rather a trickster and this annoys Taran because he's very mischievous. And he kind of hears a squeal, and he finds out that Henwen is actually being chased by this giant-like creature that serves the Horn King. And he intends to rescue her, but it doesn't happen. And that's when he kind of heads for the castle. And Gurgi's like, yeah, no, I'm out. Peace. You have fun. I know what goes on in that castle. And that's when you were interested. He sneaks in, finds his way to the banquet hall filled with the king's partying henchmen, which I have on in the background. And it's just hysterical. It's a little over the top. The beer winch dancing lady. They're celebrating that they've captured Henwen, basically. And this is when Creeper appears first, which reminds me of kind of Feldman in
Marty Feldman
in Frankenstein. Like it does. It really does. Like I can't help it, but it does. So Andy, go ahead and tell me what you're thinking about. I'm sorry.
Maybe part of his character design was influenced by Marty Feldman. Could be. And
it could have been, but that's where I go with that immediately with my brain. But this is where you were talking about him, and we're in the castle. So how do you feel about this introduction to the Creeper and the henchmen and everything going on at this point?
Oh, Gurgi, I think he's cute. He's got a little almost like his introduction a little bit is like Yoda. Where Yoda is like, you know, going after the food and you know, looking for someone, found someone, have you. And I again, with my comparisons, I'm like, this looks like Mos Eisley Cantina in a dungeon. Like, it's a scum of villainy, you know, I think a scum and villainy. With the wench. Yeah, this is where I could definitely see, you know, if I'm taking a little kid to see this, if my kids were little, I don't know if my kids have even watched this movie because I've never put it on for them. But, you know, this dancing wench, and then, you know, they almost execute Henwen with a friggin', you know, chop her head off. I mean, and they show the axe going up in the air, and I'm like, what? This is, I could see why people would be turned off from it right here, because it's like, this is very Don Bluth, I guess. I guess I'm guessing Secret of NIMH here at times, because I have it on with the rats walking around here. It starts to lose me a little bit, because it's kind of like it's going a little far from where I want it to be. Actually, I don't mind it being a little scary at times, and, you know, little scary moments, but it's definitely, you know, I would love to know how the Horn King, was the Horn King always like that? Is he cursed? Like, I want more on this character. He's a very hollow villain. You know, he wants the cauldron to be this magical, you know, all-powerful being and rule the world, but okay. But where did he come from? What's his land? Did he just rule over this disgusting castle? I mean, like, what's happening? But, you know, I do like, whenever Creeper is involved, I do like perk up a little bit. Creeper and Gurgi, I think, are you know, obviously Gurgi, like, who doesn't love Gurgi? So, I got more to say, but we'll save that.
Steve, what do you think about the castle scene and the guards and them, like, basically threatening Taryn at this point over, like, make the pig show us what we want? And these little side characters are actually really cool, in my opinion.
Yeah, it's when I first saw Gurgi on the screen, it's funny, you know, Andy said he reminded him of Yoda. As soon as I saw him, I immediately, my first thought was great value Gollum from Lord of the Rings.
Yeah, Lord of the Rings. I got a Gollum vibe from him too.
To the point, I was waiting for him to at one point say my precious. That's how close it was to it. I guess Munchies and Crunchies was kind of his little saying there. But I go back and forth on Gurgi. Sometimes I find him kind of cute and innocent. Sometimes I find him a little annoying. He's kind of a weird kind of character for me. And then, like I said, the whole scene in the castle with all these drunkards and the wench dancing and like them nearly killing Henwen. It's definitely you're definitely getting to a point where you're kind of thinking to yourself, you know, did somebody release this film under the Disney name, but it's not actually Disney, you know, because it's like getting to that point. It's funny you mentioned Don Bluth, because we talked about in our last film, The Fox and the Hound, how he left the company during the production of that film. And he went on to, of course, form his own film company. You mentioned their first film, The Secret of NIMH, which came out, I think, the year before. Yeah, this feels more like a Don Bluth film and that kind of animation as opposed to a Disney film. So, yeah, it's just definitely very and like you said, yeah, it's again, it's just so, the Horn King's just so very generic. Like his only motivation is to get the cauldron to rule the world. It's like we don't really know anything else about him. It's like, you know, can we learn a little bit more about him, his backstory, like where that comes from? So, yeah, that's, you know, it's becoming very overly generic, which I think is, you know, is fine for some things. But when you're talking about a Disney film, you're not expecting generic.
I'll give you that. Not that it like makes it any better, because we're talking about the film itself, but if I remember correctly, the books that this movie is based off of, The Chronicles of Preden, you get more of what the Horn King, why he is him and who he is and all of that. It's five novels that came out between 1964 and 1969, I believe. So if you're interested in knowing more, maybe you're not, but if you are, you could check those out. And that kind of helps. There's also a pronunciation website from the gentleman that wrote the books, because these are Welsh names. So if you're ever curious, there's that too. I totally can agree with you guys, even though like it goes against me liking the movie in some ways. I can agree and understand what you're saying. So I'll totally give you that. Because I, even on my rewatch when like the dancing lady came out, was like, don't remember that. That's a, okay. I was like, moving on, don't remember that. And Andy, you said you don't think your kids have seen it. Mine has. Like several times. Mm-hmm. Still don't remember that. But it's at this point though that Taryn obviously gets introduced to the Horn King. I do have one small problem here, and that's like them threatening to cut the pig's head off. Yeah. They're not going to. Why would you cut the pig's head off? Like that would ruin what you're doing here. Like, hello. Hello. So I'm with you. I have a small problem when like they start with the whole like, let's slice off the pig's head. That doesn't get you what you want. So, okay. But Taryn obviously gets introduced to the Horn King. He's a little taken aback. He's taking orders from Creeper. Creeper's trying to force the pig to give up the location of Black Cauldron. Use your talents. Taryn kind of refuses the orders that he is, because he's the owner of the pig and he's being forced to kind of like make her do this. He ends up spooked and therefore thrown into the dungeon, and he's left to kind of brood over his failure. But you know, nay, we shouldn't worry yet. That's when a piece of the floor opens up and a magic bauble pops out, followed by a princess, and she introduces herself. Now, I always have to look this up, even though it's like one of my favorite shows. You can't just say her name the way you think you would. So I have to ask, guys, when she introduced herself and she said her name, did you go, what?
I was just kind of like, what's happening here?
So it's Alanwi, by the way, guys. Yeah. For anyone that doesn't know. It's not Elanwi, it's Alanwi. So Princess Alanwi pops up, and they start exploring. They team up, because Taryn isn't a warrior, because she's disappointed about that, which I think Taryn is disappointed about that too. Wouldn't you guys agree? Like, that's what he wants. But they decide to team up and escape the castle, and they end up exploring the dungeon, and they share their stories about how they've kind of gotten thrown into the dungeon. And Alanwi was captured because the Horn King thought her bauble could tell him where the cauldron was. And like Taryn, she was thrown into the dungeons and his plan failed. They do come across a burial chamber where Taryn obtains a sword. And then they enter a room where a minstrel is being chained by another henchman. And this minstrel, I really enjoy his character. We'll see what you guys think. Tries to convince the henchman, kind of letting go, like, but everything he says is a lie. He's cursed, and every time he lies, one of the strings on his harp snaps. They attempt to set him free, but then hear more henchmen coming and run for it. So the guard kind of attempts to kill everybody, run, running away. What do we think about this, guys? Because this is a little bit of a drawn-out process, I won't lie. Like, this takes a hot minute. So how do we feel about being down in the dungeon, the introduction of the two new characters, Alanwi and our minstrel? What do we think, Steve?
So more great value here, as Alanwi is definitely great value. Princess Zelda, to the point that you just put a pair of elf ears on her. It's like a perfect match. So, and again, it's just like, she just appears out of nowhere. It's like, we don't know anything about her. It's like, what kingdom is she from? Like, what's her backstory? It's just like, she's here. Oh, let's team up and, you know, get out of here. And then Taryn gets the sword again, you know, kind of more Zelda, because it reminds me a lot of the Master Sword. It's like, it's magic. It's, you know, it helps them fight off the henchmen. And, I'm with you. I do kind of enjoy, I think Flam is good. kind of comic fodder, because you kind of need that at this point, because mm-hmm. it's because of the tone the film's been setting. You need some comic relief. I know you have a little bit of that with Gergi, and now you have it with him. And just their escape just takes feels like it takes forever. And eventually they get out. They do eventually get out. But just the constant similarities to The Legend of Zelda and The Lord of the Rings are just constantly there.
I don't know. I just find it it's derivative, and it's like a mishmash to me of like other stories. It doesn't deserve that, but just how I do it. Like, you know what, you watch some movies like the movie John Carter when that came out, and everybody's like, oh, that's derivative. I'm like, actually the source material came out before Indiana Jones and all these other movies that they were the ones that took it from. So, you know, this movie, the source material on this, I can definitely see like where I'm like, you know, this is great value Aurora. This is, you know, this one, you know, is reminding me of Wart. And this is a, you know, our adult character is Fleur Flem, whatever his name is.
He's Merlin.
Yeah, the escape took a bit while, and all of a sudden this magic sword shows up. I mean, and when Eloni shows up, I just like, she comes out of nowhere. I'm like, no, who is this? Like, where is they coming from? Like, there's more people in this dungeon besides these bad guys. Like, it was in this castle. It was, I don't know. I guess I just started to zone out, I guess, on this at times. And I was not as receptive to going on the journeys that the story wanted to take me on at times. I don't know. Maybe that's just me.
I'll give you that. Although I do have to add that this came out before Zelda, but okay.
I don't know. Maybe Nintendo was inspired. Maybe somebody from Nintendo watched the film and they were inspired by it.
Maybe.
I called the thing a Pensy. Maybe J.K. Rowling was watching this with her kids one day. It was like, oh, that looks cool. But what if you took like a little memory out of your head and dropped it in there? How would that look?
She may have. Everything comes from something else. So I'm with you guys. I get frustrated when it's like repetitive or like direct, like blatant copying. There are a lot of similarities in this movie and Sword and Stone, and I see them as an adult, and I even saw them now. But I think, like you said, back when we watched Sword and Stone, I loved that movie a lot, and I love this one a lot. And it's obviously those similarities that grabbed my attention. And there even are some Lord of the Rings type-esque things. Obviously, Lord of the Rings was set 10 years before the source material for this movie came out. So it's very possible that he was influenced by Tolkien to write his books of Prydain. So maybe. Clearly, there's a long fight scene. I'm with you guys. Excellent movie. That's a long fight. That's a long fight/getaway scene. There are some really funny parts to it, though. The minstrel getting away from a dog who had hold of his pant. The dog just looks so defeated that he didn't get him. He ends up kind of passing out. But they get away. But at this point, that's a problem for Creeper. Poor Creeper. You kind of hate that you love him, because he's the bad guy, right? But poor Creeper has to go back and nervously tell the Horn King that the Pig Keeper has escaped. And Creeper has some punishment. But he's surprised, though. Even though the Horn King tries to choke him, he's surprised to find out that he actually kind of likes this news. Because if Taran has escaped, then that means he will go find his pig. And the Horn King can just capture them both again. And the king orders him to send the dragon creature to follow the boy, which Creeper thankfully does. Now, in the forest, the minstrel is singing to the heroes, the only song in the film, actually, while Alanwi is sewing his pants back up because the dog just chewed them off of him. They're all extremely thankful that they made it out of the castle alive, but Taran starts really to become arrogant here, and we saw this at the beginning of the movie. As well, he's like, I'm not afraid of him. I'm not afraid of him. And Alanwi kind of gets into an argument with him, and she ends up running off crying. And Taran storms in the opposite direction, kind of ignoring the minstrel's attempts to make peace. He does end up apologizing to her, and she forgives him immediately because she says they need to work together to find the cauldron before the Horn King does. And that's when they hear our lovely minstrel yell for help. And Taryn draws a sword in case of danger, but he puts it away when he realizes that it's just Gurgi. It's just Gurgi. So we've escaped the castle that took 11 billion years. And how do we think of this little sequence here? A kind of just like, breather, palate cleanser. How do we feel about it, Steve?
Yeah, poor Creeper. He's, you know, having to explain everything. And at one point, he actually, to prevent the King Horn King from choking him, he chokes himself. So, yeah, that's kind of that was a little funny scene there. Again, it's like, these characters all come together and like, but it's like we still really know nothing about, you know, Alanwi, and we don't know about, you know, Flam, like where they came from. It's like, and it's kind of like I said, Taryn gets a little too big for his own head, you know, kind of saying like all that he saved them, when and Alanwi kind of has to bring him back down to earth, and you know they have their little the little spat there, but then eventually quickly, reconcile. But it's like, you know, I like a little bit more backstory on these characters, you know, like where they came from, what their motivation is. Like, you know, give us a little bit more of that. I know you mentioned about how it's like, yeah, we're getting source material from a series of 5 books. So it's kind of hard to do all that, but you know, at least a little bit more would have been nice.
Yeah. Maybe they were overly ambitious and the source material is just too dense for a 82-85 minute animated film. Could be part of it too. Go ahead.
Well, I was about to say, unless they wanted to be the first of a series, like if they had plans to keep going with it, which eventually,
Disney didn't do sequels that much though. Sequels were not their thing, really. I mean, you know, Rescuers Down Under is the first, proper sequel that we actually get, and you go back, and that's there. What? How many sequels have there been, really? In the proper. I mean, there's the direct to video and some of the other things, but you know, I think it was just the second Frozen movie. I think that's the only other sequel. I mean, Fantasia 2000 is like a continuation on a storytelling. They retain like one or two things. I think Fantasia was never meant to be completed, like kind of like Disneyland. Like it was never meant to be a complete thing. So I can't see them wanting to do sequels. I think maybe this was just way too much they had to get in here, and they just couldn't do it. It would in order to hold attention. I mean, this is a ragtag group. Here, and I like, you know, Gurgi, you know, coming back and being part of this team. I mean, he does have a very important part of this in this movie, but it's just, yeah, it's kind of like that's where kind of it loses me too. It's like I just don't understand like where they're coming from and why are they here and what happened, and it's I just like Steve says, I need a little more backstory here.
Okay, I'll definitely, I will give you that, because while I still will defend this movie, I love this movie, I could understand other people's need for more to the story. Kind of like in our last movie that we watched in Fox and the Hound, you guys enjoyed it a little bit more than I did because I wanted more from certain parts of the story. So I will give you that without arguing and telling you you're wrong, because it makes sense. There are parts of this story, though, where I feel like we get too much, if that makes sense. Where we need more explanation on the characters and who they are, we get like too much. Like the fight or flight sequence, let's call it that we were talking about a moment ago. It's a little too long. We could have taken that time and explained who these people were. Mm-hmm. Would you agree?
Yep.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So Gurgi has joined our crew now after he said, nope, not going to the castle, not going there. You can do that. But Gurgi has joined them and sneaks into the castle, kind of evading these horrifying soldiers that have been brought to life, right? I think my brain has just scooped ahead a little too far.
We haven't talked about these fairy things yet.
We haven't talked about these fairy things.
Or the Great Value Sanderson sisters.
Oh, my Lord. Gurgi is back with our friends, and a lot happens. Gurgi does end up at the castle, but they go on a little adventure on their way back to the castle. And apparently everything is a great value something this evening. another argument has ensued, and Gurgi has revealed where Hinwin is. He's like, I know, I'll take you exactly. And they're in an enchanted whirlpool and have been sucked down. They find themselves in this amazing underground universe that's peopled by pixies and ruled by their very kindly king. But he does not like humans in his home, and the world pale is kind of maintained by this bad-tempered court workman who's supposed to keep them out. But he kind of decides to help them, and he knows where the Black Cauldron is, and he instructs them to be taking to take them to Morva, the land where it's hidden. He also has Hinwin, and she and Taryn are reunited. But during all this, these little pixies, we meet them. So apparently we have thoughts on the pixies. What do we think about these pixies, guys? Andy?
Well, they're like Smurfs had sex with fairies. I mean, and then you get and you get Grouchy Smurf here to, like, you know, be the one to go out with them. It's like, oh my God. Or it's like, or Grumpy, the dwarf. It's just, I was kind of out on these guys. I was just like, I had all things going in my head. I'm like, in my notes, I'm like, dozers, underpants gnomes. I'm like, I think at this point, like, I was starting, my brain was starting to, like, wander, I guess, because of the storytelling elements that were lacking. I mean, they're fine. I think they're, this is where they're trying to get the kids back on board, I guess, with these cute pixie characters. But then, you know, they send Grouchy out with them. And then, I mean, Gurgi can't carry the cute factor on his own, I guess, is what they're trying to say.
I think, okay. Steve, how do we feel about the fairies? I know how I feel about the fairies. Andy clearly has thoughts. So what do you think?
there's a good song for a Disney film. Time to go to work on that. Search for our underpants week.
Underpants are big business.
What's phase two?
Phase one, underpants. Phase three, profit. What's phase two? Phase one. Sorry. All
right.
I didn't have a big of an issue with the fairies that Andy did. Actually, it's funny when he mentioned when Dolly definitely is very reminiscent of Grumpy. That was my first thought with it. I think Andy's right. You definitely had to get a little bit of this, like, fantasy, like, more of a fantasy element to it to kind of bring the kids back into it. So you have these, you know, good fairies who kind of take to these guys, and eventually, they reveal where the cauldron is, and they help lead the way, and they kept Hinwin safe. So, I mean, it was fine for what it was.
Okay, I'll give you that. The cauldron, as it turns out, because they do take them through magical means to the cauldron, and it's in a cottage governed by three witches that Andy has already indicated are the Great Value Sanderson sisters. It's funny. I am not even going to try to say their names because I will butcher the crap out of them. But they have strong implication that they are humans who stole from the witches in the past, who in this thing of frogs. All these frogs are apparently humans who stole from the witches in the past. And they're going to eat them. I mean, frog legs aren't bad. I will say that. But one of the sisters takes a fancy to our minstrel friend and will not allow him to be turned into a frog. and the witches reveal that they never give anything away. They only trade. So Taryn, seeing that they have nothing else of value to offer, he trades his sword for the cauldron. A storm blows up and the heroes are transported outside. The earth shakes and the black cauldron emerges from it. These witches, now in the form of clouds, inform the heroes that the black cauldron can never be destroyed, but only its evil powers can be stopped. And a living being must climb into the cauldron of his own free will. However, the good person will never climb out of this cauldron again. And then they disappear, saying that they always keep a bargain. Gurgi, in a rare burst of bravery, has agreed to go into the cauldron, but on hearing that he will die, he ain't got that courage no more. Courage is gone. Courage is gone. So what do we think about where this cauldron has been hidden this whole time? Also, why do the sisters remind me of the godmothers fighting over pink and blue in Sleeping Beauty? I'm just saying, it does. I get that, like they're, you know, the godmothers were beautiful, but these, like, I really get that vibe from them. So how did we feel about this, where the cauldron is placed, these witches, sisters, and where they have to move forward with the cauldron, Steve?
Yeah, it's great value, Sanderson sisters. That's a good one. They were definitely very unique in their, like, in how they were, how they acted. The one that falls in love with Flam and won't let her other witches eat him. But funny point, they're searching, Gurgi kind of says, you know, I found the cauldron. He leads them into a room and it's like filled with cauldrons. So it's like, okay, come on, Gurgi. we're looking for one specific one, not a whole bunch of random ones.
Like Gurgi knew which was specific. Right? He's never seen the Black Cauldron. He just found a bunch of Black Cauldrons.
Good point. Yeah, that's true, I guess.
I gotta defend Gurgi. I'm sorry.
It's like when you tell a kid, like, I need a crayon, or I need some. I don't know, crayon's bad, but you're like, I need this, and then they're like, here it is, and you're like, not okay. Thank you, but not that one. I'm like.
Pretty sneaky of them to get Taryn to trade the sword for the cauldron, and then basically telling them that, like, oh yeah, it's indestructible. You have to have somebody their free will to climb into it to actually stop its powers. So kind of a, you know, little sneaky move there by those witches. And Taryn at this point is kind of reached his low point. It's like, you know, he kind of just kind of resigns himself to the fact that he's not going to be a warrior anymore. He's just a pig's assistant. And Alanwi kind of tells them, you know, you are, you know, you're special for who you are. And that one brief moment where it looks like they're about to kiss, but then Gurgi kind of ruins it by kissing Flam. I thought the witches were fine. And this whole thing was like that kind of that reveal of the cauldron, I thought, was actually pretty cool. Okay. With it kind of, you know, coming out of the ground.
That was pretty funny. Andy, I clearly know that they are bad knockoffs of the Sanderson sisters. I know how you feel about that. But how do you feel about this overall? I will have to add, I should have said this earlier, one of my favorite parts of this is when they're fighting over, like, you can't eat them. I like him. The thing that I had kind of forgotten about until I was rewatching this was that the frog keeps getting stuck in her cleavage. Like, he's stuck in her bosom. And it just keeps showing you her bosoms and the frog stuck there. And I was like, okay. Yeah, we're doing that.
Yeah, that's one of the things I wrote in my notes. I'm like, what? I mean, with the huge boobs and, you know, she says, don't you don't mind if I pluck your harp? And it gets stuck in her cleavage, and then she's just overly amorous with this guy. I like elements of these characters. I don't like that part of it at all. I don't think it belongs here. I think, you know, they have to give, you know, her a reason. We have to give the sisters a reason to kind of bicker amongst themselves. But I kind of cringed about it. I do like, though, that they, had the fine print. You know, they didn't tell him about it. You kind of see now what's going to have to happen. Once somebody's going to have to go into this cauldron, you know, there's going to have to be a sacrifice at some point, basically, in order to stop, you know, the needs of the many outweigh the needs of the few. Again, good elements, good storytelling parts of it, but it's just not in the right aisle of the supermarket, so to speak. You know, it's not where it should be. This is not things that should be in. It's just the movie has came so dark that it's just like it's hard to recover. And I did like the introduction of these witches and their little part in the story, but I just don't like the one, you know, well endowed one to be obsessed with Flurflum, whatever the hell his name is.
I do like how they appear in the cloud and come back.
That part's like cool, I think, actually.
Yeah, and they come back and they explain, because to me, it leads into a trope of, we've touched on this show a couple other times, and we'll obviously talk about it way more as we continue down the list of movies. But in our first 25, we have mentioned a couple times Once Upon a Time. And it was at this moment that I thought about this show again, because it's like what Mr. Gold is always saying, magic comes at a price, dearie.
Oh, dearie.
Dearie. Yeah, magic comes at a price. And it's at this point where of the movie where we finally understand of all the magic we've seen so far, it comes at a price. And the cauldron does not escape that. So now we have to figure out what to do with this cauldron, right? They're all hanging around the fire, and our little fairy friend Dolly gets frustrated and disappears, and Taran blurts out that he is now nothing without his sword. But Alanwi kind of assures him that you are somebody, you just have to believe in yourself. Taran is about to reply when Gurgi and Minstrel look with happy eyes, seeing that the pair are kind of like attracted to each other, right? But nothing really happens. For lots of reasons, but that's when our dragon thing circles above their heads, and he's kind of found them, which was his job. So Gurgi is actually able to sneak to safety, but the others try to make a run for it. They're kind of stopped in their tracks when the Horn King's henchmen, and Gurgi looks very sad as he kind of watches them be captured. Back at the castle, though, Creeper, orders another cart to be taken into the castle, and he taunts the three captured friends while preparing the cauldron for his master, which is what he's wanted the whole time. He's wanted this cauldron. The king enters, acknowledges the three heroes, basically thanks them for finding the cauldron for him, and then prepares them for what fate has in store, basically. He actually says, what fate has in store for you. Picks up a dead warrior, puts it in the cauldron, and begins his great spell. The cauldron then brings all the dead warriors to life in the castle and transforms them into what we were told about at the beginning, our cauldron born. All the Horned King's henchmen run away in fear, actually, which, if you think about it, is quite funny that his new henchmen are terrifying his original henchmen. These three heroes also begin to disappear or despair rather. I don't know why I said disappear. I know what the word is. Ugh. They're kind of like desperate, and they're sad because, I mean, if you saw these guys come up out of the cauldron, you'd be like, well, shit, this is over.
I'm out of here.
Right. I am done. And end scene. But Creeper takes his master to the tallest tower so he can get a better view of all the undead leaving the castle. This is when Gurgi, earlier I was trying to jump ahead to, Gurgi sneaking into the castle and evading all these horrifying soldiers. So if you ask me at this point, Gurgi is quite brave. Thought he was a coward this whole time. He's quite brave sneaking past these creepy looking creatures. He reaches Taran and the others and he rescues everyone. And he remembers the witch's advice. And Taran makes up his mind then and there that he'll sacrifice himself to destroy the black magic. Of course, Alanwi begs him not to, but is unable to stop him, and Gurgi jumps in front of him and insists that he will sacrifice himself instead. And he walks toward the cauldron, and he says in his final sad words, Taran has many friends. Gurgi has no friends. So Taran tries to stop him again, but Gurgi jumps into the cauldron and destroys the black magic. So what did we think about, which we knew was going to happen, what did we think about the Horned King kind of capturing them in the middle of the forest in this kind of in very sweet scene between Alanwi and Taran, and then getting his hands on the cauldron and doing exactly what we all thought he was going to do. But what do we think about the sequence and how they laid it out and the going back and forth between the who's going to jump in the cauldron and who's not? Andy, you go first this time.
Yeah, I liked it. I mean, I like, you know, he's a typical really good villain where he, in that part where he's just like, thanks for doing, you know, you did all the hard work for me. I think this is probably the best animated sequence of the whole movie is when he, you know, he puts this, the skeleton warrior in the cauldron, and then you get the green stuff coming out, and then now they're kind of spooky looking, and them crossing the bridge is a great visual. I mean, I did feel bad for Gurgi. I mean, I started to feel like Gurgi, this is going to be Gurgi's hero moment here, because he's not yet there. And also, they're not going to have a kid sacrifice himself. I was waiting for Flurf to step up, you know, and sacrifice himself. I mean, he's old. He's lived his life. You know, what the hell? But I really love that Gurgi was given this, because Gurgi really hadn't really, I mean, he kind of like had some little moments in here and there, but he didn't have his big moment, which I really do like here. And I felt bad where, you know, when he said Gurgi has no friends, I mean, I fell for him, and I'm like, no, he's going to jump Gurgi. Like, I literally, like, I was a little sad, and I was hoping maybe some fantastical element was going to happen later on in the movie, and maybe it does, maybe it doesn't. But I mean, I think this is, the movie does pick up here with a great sequence of events.
Steve, what do you think about this specific sequence? And I have to quickly interject that as I'm looking over on this at this on my iPad, out of nowhere, and after 37 years, I finally realized who the Horned King reminds me of. And it's Skeletor, but not as great.
Yeah. You just don't want to say Great Value Skeletor. That's all.
I'm not calling him Great Value Skeletor. I'll give you a little bit more than that. He's Tarjay Skeletor. I still really like this movie. So. He's Tarjay
Skeletor. Red Circle Skeletor. Yeah. What do they call it? Yeah, those. That's funny. I don't know.
He's not the Wish version, but he's from Amazon, so.
Oh, I'm going off the rails here. I thought it was definitely a great kind of climax to the film. That scene where the dead kind of come to life and are marching out of the castle, definitely kind of cool little scene there. And like you said, you knew somebody was gonna eventually make the sacrifice, and you figured you know, and obviously, you know, Taran thinks he's, you know, going to be the one to do it. But you kind of almost figured it was going to be Gurgi in the end, because, you know, he had spent the whole majority of the film always running away from danger. And he kind of gets to a point where it's like, now he has to face the danger. And yeah, that moment where he jumps into the cauldron is very intense. And I will say it is kind of a little bit anticlimactic, because it's like we never see these undead soldiers actually, you know, do anything other than just march out of the castle. And then they've eventually, after, you know, Gurgi jumps in and the evil power kind of dissipates, they just kind of collapse back to dust. And yeah, it just kind of felt a bit anticlimactic in that way. And why does the... I still kind of am confused as to why the Horn King gets sucked into the cauldron. That kind of doesn't... kind of always kind of puzzled me. I mean, it's a cool kind of visual seeing him kind of disintegrate into dust and, you know, get sucked into this cauldron. And then the scene where the castle collapses is really cool, too. But, yeah, I mean, the whole the sequence is good. It's a good kind of final ending to the Horn King and to his minions. But just a slight bit anticlimactic, in my opinion.
I thought it was... I put weak as Horn King's death or demise, whatever you want to call it. I thought this was a shit way to finish, to get rid of this villain. Basically, you know, Taran kicks him, and then the wind picks him up. I mean, that's really what it is. Like, a strong gust of wind is what takes care of the Horn King. I don't like it. You know, this guy's supposed to be so badass, you gotta give him a badass death.
Well, okay, I'll give you that. So the Horn King obviously watches his army fall apart. And he blames Creeper for the screw-up, because he blames Creeper for everything. And he decides to throw him in the cauldron and try to rework the spell. Obviously, that doesn't work. Taran and Alanwi leave the castle while they attempt to save Gurgi as well. And King and Creeper kind of enter the chamber, and they see Taran's free. Creeper blames Taran for this whole incident. And that's when the King got really pissed off, basically. And he's like, "You've interfered for the last time. You shall die." Clearly, that does not happen. He attempts to throw Taran into the cauldron, and the wind issuing from the cauldron turns on him, and he cannot escape. That's when, as Andy said, he kind of screams angrily, and he's violently sucked into the cauldron, and he's gone. Creeper oddly begins to mourn for his master. But at the same time, he's like, "Wait, I'm free and I'm never going to be choked or throttled again." And he starts laughing, like just crazy laughing. And the cauldron just sinks back into the ground. And that's when the castle begins to crumble. And so Taran has to find his friends. They escape in a longboat as the castle continues to just fall in the water. Creeper, who is still laughing all the while, flies away on the giant dragon that I cannot say his name because it's in Welsh. They have made it to shore, and the cauldron arises from the water, and again in the form of the clouds, the witches reappear and decide that the heroes have no more use for this cauldron, and they prepare to take it back. But the minstrel reminds them that they always keep their bargain of a trade. But she doesn't want to give up the sword. But the other sisters do. They're like, no. Or Orda and Orwin are like, just give it back. So they give it to Taran. But Taran really doesn't need the sword anymore. But he'll trade it for Gurgi's life. And the sisters are like, this is impossible. But when the minstrel starts goading at them, they take away the cauldron and the sword and leave a lifeless Gurgi in the cauldron's place. And obviously this is very upsetting, and I found it upsetting as well. And they look at him tearfully at Gurgi, and Taran picks him up and holds him. And very suddenly, Gurgi reaches for munchies and crunchies, and everyone is very excited to see him alive again. So at this point, Taran and Alanwi have their heads together, staring at each other, and they finally share what every Hallmark young lady that loved Disney always wanted, which they didn't get in the new Star Wars, but I digress. Well, they did, but then nothing happened, but whatever. I won't go there in this episode. And they share their kiss. They all head home together, back at the farm. Everyone is reliving and watching the heroic visions, because remember, Henwin can show you visions of shit. And they all agree that Taran did very, very well on his first adventure. So before I ask both of you to tell me how you feel about that complete end close to our movie here, I have to give my opinion for Andy calls weak death of the Horn King. I don't disagree that it should have been more climatic. Like, built up. Like, great. Amazing. Woo! Right? I mean, it's the death of the big bad. But I think it all plays into the cauldron because the whole someone has to go in, it's, you know, strong black magic, and maybe the cauldron felt his evil pull and wanted his evil for itself. I don't know, because clearly the cauldron's somewhat cognizant, I would say. I mean, it's magic, right? Right? Mm-hmm. So that's a weird explanation. And yes, it could have been better. But I kind of like that in the end, what he wanted to be his, what he wanted to give him so much power actually took it away from him, took away everything from him. The cauldron was supposed to be his saving grace, and at the end, it's what killed him. So,
they do it better in a later movie. This almost this very similar sequence. They do it much better in a later movie. That
okay.
May rhyme with Shmanadin, but okay.
They had time to figure it out.
Yes, okay. It was all kind right, of terrifying right. too, though. I cannot, again, another scene that they will turn off the children, because it's kind of terrifying. He like turns into like a skeleton or dust or whatever. It's
yeah.
Okay. Sorry. Go ahead, Steve.
No, you're fine. Steve, go ahead. Tell me how you feel. If you want to elaborate on his death. The bringing back of the sisters, like kind of our whole ending here of like, what I really like is that our minstrel is reminding them like, oh, hey, you said you know, you really care about me and you have this bargain. So how did you feel about all this closing out here?
I agree with that. I like how, cause this whole time we've been led to believe that the minstrel is kind of a dunce and not really mm-hmm. that smart. But in the end, he kind of has his moment where he kind of, has the witches in a corner and basically like forces them to kind of act out on their word. I do like that Creeper survived, that he kind of got a, you know, and that he kind of got his like, you know, his freedom, because he, like you said, like he's, you know, kind of like upset at first, and he's kind of like, wait, I'm free now, and he's like celebrating it. That kind of moment where the witches want to give the sword back, and Taren has the realization that he's no hero. He's not a warrior. He is just a simple, you know, pig, as he calls himself, a pig boy. And he's willing to accept that because he just wants to have that. He just wants Gurgi back. So they kind of, you know, again, with the minstrels kind of smarts, they kind of work the witches around to take the culture back and having them give Gurgi back. And that brief moment, you think like, well, they got him back, but he's still dead. And then you realize that he's alive, and you know, like everyone gets happy. And it's funny, you mentioned them kissing. If you notice, Gurgi pushed them together for that kiss. So, mm-hmm. you know, I mean, yeah, they were kind of going to do it anyway, but it's almost kind of like, you know, kind of like forced, almost like, I don't want to say forced it on, but it's like, you know, just again, yeah. And then, like that little scene there where like they're kind of like these like four new like this new family's kind of walking off into the distance is a nice little way to kind of close things out. So it was a good end to the film.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's a good ending. I was, you know, like I said earlier, I was hoping that some kind of fantastical element was going to bring Gurgi back after his heroic sacrifice. You know, I love that he asked Fleur de Flam. I know Miranda is playing it safe by calling him the minstrel. I laugh at danger. I go to pronounce everything wrongly. I don't give a crap. No, I think he does have his moment where he serves his purpose, where he you know, outsmarts them. And then the whole thing though is that, you know, Dalvin has been watching all. What has he been watching all along? And just like kind of like sat back, and was like not interfering at all or helping them. If he's got all this like, I don't know. Like what is Dalvin? Like what? I mean, that kind of just, you know, it reminds me, again, another great analogy here. Reminds me of the end of The Lost Boys, when the grandfather, after they, you know, kill off, spoilers for The Lost Boys, after they kill off the head vampire, mm-hmm. Edward Herman, I can't remember his name, Max, I think, tough as it. After they kill him off, the grandfather, you know, comes in, grabs the Dr. Pepper, and is like, one thing over all these years of living in Santa Carla, all the damn vampires. And they're like, you knew? Like, that's the look on their
right,
face.
Right, like, you knew this. Like this,
I'm like, oh, that was kind of my look. Like, so he's been, like, watching along the whole time, like, and he could have done something else. Or something. I don't know. I'm confused.
That I'm also not sure on, so I will give you that. I'm not sure.
But I think it's a fine movie. I just didn't love it. That's all. You know, I think there, like I said earlier, and Steve mentioned something like this, there this source material probably has a lot more, and the book is probably way better because it has time to go through all these things. I mean, mm-hmm. you know, we also talked about Harry Potter a little bit. Like, there are things from the Harry Potter books I am so glad didn't get into the movies. So maybe there was some stuff that was even worse, but I think this was a little ambitious. Maybe it wasn't the best choice, I think, for the Disney company to do at this time. As you guys have mentioned, that it's the film that almost killed Disney. But it's I did enjoy the ending, and I mean, I'd probably give this movie a 5, 5.5 if I'm doing a rating scale. Steve, what'd you rate this in your reviews?
I rated it 5.5 as well. It's definitely, like I said, it wasn't, I didn't think it was nearly as bad as the reputation had stated, but it's definitely in the lower, like, lower third of the Disney films. So I think it's, you know, slightly, you know, below average for, in my opinion. It's not, again, not the worst, not the best, you know, about, again, bottom third for me at least.
A 9. It gets a 9. Not a 10, because upon rewatching it, the dancing lady and witch boobies were a little much for a kid's film, in my opinion. I can go with some darker tones, but for some reason, the boobies bother me.
Yeah. Yeah, I didn't like that.
I don't know why. So some facts that I look up, and I've been holding this in this whole time. I'm holding this in. But apparently, while The Black Cauldron technically did bomb on its U.S. release, it did positively well, like super well worldwide, especially in Japan. It was a big hit with Japanese audiences in 1985, which is 1 year before the release of our landmark video game that we have referenced multiple times, The Legend of Zelda. And it has led some fans to speculate that the film was a key influence on Zelda's creator. We shall never know. We shall never know. But he does claim he, the creator, does claim he drew influence from his childhood exploring caves, forests, and mountains. So maybe it's just coincident. It is based on Welsh mythology, blah, 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 blah. Of course, directly, it is an adaptation of Lloyd Alexander's series of novels, The Chronicles of Pretty Dan. The novels were themselves based on a very early Welsh myth as well, that you can actually see a screenshot of it, of like in Welsh. I can't read it, but it's super cool. Lloyd Alexander, though, if it makes the two of you feel better, actually was for the most part pleased with the film, but he said he did have mixed feelings. And he said there is no resemblance between the movie and the book. And having said that, the movie in itself, purely as a movie, I found it very enjoyable. What I would hope is that anyone who sees the movie would certainly enjoy it, but would also hope that they would actually take the time to read the books, as the book is quite different. And it's funny, because we mentioned Tim Burton last episode, and he also is part of this as well, where he was uncredited on The Fox and the Hound, which was our previous 24th movie. We're on number 25. He actually had way more of a part in this one, and he is kind of – what's funny is obviously he's more darker, and he did a lot of the concept art for this film. Obviously, with the dark tone, he was a very perfect fit for this project, and we'll talk about some of his other works much later. What's funny is he didn't last at Disney at this point. He actually was fired for his macabre taste, as it says, which is funny knowing what comes later in our lineup. But yeah, so that kind of like threw me off when I found out that he was fired by Disney. And then anyway, so any last thoughts? We gave it a rating, gave our opinions. Miranda still enjoys it quite well, obviously, based on our ratings. Do you guys have any last thoughts? Like, did you at least enjoy your rewatch or your watch of this movie?
I definitely did. I think if you go into it with an open mind and not kind of hang your hat on its reputation, I think you will enjoy yourself, even if you've never read or if you're familiar with the books. I think it's definitely an interesting kind of film for its time. Coming out of the 70s and into the 80s, you know, because I mean, compare this one to the last film we watched, The Fox and the Hound, and they feel like two completely different companies.
Absolutely.
And I think you could definitely tell that this was a turning point for Disney. And after like you said, the failed performance at in North America, I mean, and the fact that the film was not released on home video for 13 years, I think definitely gives you a indication of how they eventually felt, and that they needed to with their next film kind of rebound from it. And I think if you really think about it, without this film, maybe we don't get the motivation. They don't have the motivation to, you know, kind of improve on it. And maybe we don't end up getting what we get at the end of the decade with the Disney Renaissance. So as much as I think there are those who kind of dismiss the film as being one of the weaker entries, I think you can argue that it's one of the more influential films that they've ever done in terms of what we eventually get in the future.
Andy, any last thoughts?
I'm glad I was kind of not forced is not really the right word, but I'm glad that I had to watch it I had a reason to watch it, because as you know, there's so much out there content wise, and you know, we're all watching shows or movies and we're trying to catch up or keep, you know, I'm glad I had a reason to watch this movie, because I haven't watched it in probably since I was a kid at some point. So I'm glad I did. I did like some elements of the story. I would, if I, you know, if I'm in Disney and I see a plush Gurgi, I may actually pick it up. I would love to have seen, Creeper kind of get, a little shine somewhere, like in one of those, like, you know, compilation things, or, I mean, I'd have to go back and rewatch like House of Mouse or House of Villains and see, because they were like little lesser known characters sometimes get little moments here and there. But yeah, I definitely agree with Steve's points. Like, you know, if they didn't hit a low, maybe they wouldn't aim to improve and go high. So it's definitely an important film in the terms of the canon.
Okay. I'll definitely give you that. Well, let's see. Before I go spewing all of my internet information, which is not that much, Steve, why don't you tell us what you have coming up, where people can find you, anything cool you have going on?
Sure. Well, of course, besides this show, I also host Mickey Mount Rushmore here on the P2B and Pop Experience, where I have several guests on. We discuss various topics. Since it is December, our episode will definitely be Christmas themed. So I'll just kind of leave it at that, give you a little teaser. You can usually find me over on Facebook, on the Place to Be Facebook page. Lots of great stuff going on there. By the time this episode drops, our greatest TV drama tournament may have already wrapped up or is about to wrap up. So,
I think it'll be over.
Yeah, so we'll figure out who Place to Be Nation decided as the greatest TV drama of all time. Looking forward to seeing what ends up winning that. So, check that out. Check all the other great stuff here on the Pop feed, as well as our sister feeds, the Place to Be Wrestling feed, the North South Connection feed, and the Jenny Position.
Awesome. Andy, what do you have going on, and where can the people find you?
Not much of the social media presence, just the Facebook, and we have a Twitter, Pop Experience. I believe our friend Sean actually runs that. Just come join the Facebook group if you're not part of it. But on here, this very feed, I have several shows that I co-host with different people, including Miranda. That is the Most Sensational, Inspirational, Celebrational, Muppetational podcast, which we drop. Hopefully we'll get back into a monthly rhythm. I also do Year in Pop, which you'll have an episode this month, as well as new episodes of Laughing Theater and Blockbuster Rewatch dropping all the time. Those are my live watch mods. And and also check me out on Stream Lounge. I've started to do a little more frequency on there. I'm going through the entire MCU. I also plan to do Star Wars from the beginning. I have other Laughing Theater episodes that are on there. And once they get some more streaming services on board, certain ones that a box office you would watch in your home to the max, Harry Potter is on the table and all other kinds of great movies. So there's a lot of possibilities over there, and of course everything that I do in Stream Lounge will be released in audio form as a pod. Also, this month it is December. I have two Laughing Theater Christmas episode group watches, like I did last year. This year I am doing Scrooged and Four Christmases, and you may hear these voices on one or the other show. So check that out.
Yeah. So we basically have something for everyone here, whether it's actually on Place to Be or any of the other podcast feeds that Steve and Andy have both mentioned. Of course, please come join us in the Facebook group. We talk about just about everything there is. And with it's gearing up, getting closer to Christmas, there'll be all kinds of funny things that we've done in the past, like your favorite candy and cookies. And we have some arguments, and I like to say things like, how about we get rid of the person that makes me pick which food I have to pick out of these, because why should anyone make you do that? There's a lot going on in the group, and there's literally something for everyone. I will enter and respond in the group as well as on Instagram. I kind of love Instagram, where everybody else maybe doesn't so much. They're over on Twitter. I'll explain. Twitter is too much for my ADHD brain. It is just, whoa. So apologize if you don't see me there. So, of course, Andy already mentioned the other podcast that I appear with him on, but I kind of am all over the place. I am on the Jenny Position. I am here, and we have been making quite a home over on Stream Lounge as well. So go back and check those out if you want to listen to them here in podcast form. Of course you can, or you can go over there and watch Andy and I be silly and me be up way past my bedtime like I am again here, which is okay, but it's still I'm gonna rib them both about it. So we have a whole lot going on in the month of December. One thing that should be going now that I forgot to mention last month, and you should hopefully hear about it there, here and there. If you followed the group in October, you saw I did a 31 Days of Halloween. And let's just say it should be a wonderful and maybe amazing list of Christmas movies for you to follow along for 25 days of Place to Be as well. So check that out. And of course, come back here next month as we get to talking about another amazing Disney film, but Steve and I will agree is a fantastically amazing, highly underrated, the 26th animated feature. Next month will be The Great Mouse Detective. But until then, I am Miranda Berthold. For myself, Steve, and Andy, we thank you for joining us and hope to see you soon.